Hi, Here and Now podcast listeners. This is Peter O'Dowd. I've got a favor to ask of you. If you could just take a few minutes, go to hereandnow.org/survey. It's all one word. You can tell us more about yourself. It's going to take less than 5 minutes, and your feedback will help us improve this podcast. hereandnow.org/survey. Answer just a few questions. Again, it's hereandnow.org/survey. And thanks. From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As expected, the president released a new budget proposal today. It slashes domestic programs and State Department funding while ramping up military spending, and it includes more than $8 billion to fund the border wall, even as the Senate will probably vote against the president's emergency declaration at the southern border as soon as this week, which promises to be another eventful one on Capitol Hill. NPR White House correspondent Mara Liasson is here. Hi, Mara.
Hi there.
And let's listen for a second. White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow defending Trump's request for border wall spending. This is on Fox News Sunday.
I would just say that the whole issue of the wall and border security is of paramount importance. We have a crisis down there. I think the president has made that case very effectively. It's a crisis of economics. It's a crisis of crime and drugs. It's a crisis of humanity.
But Mara, as you well know, polls show most Americans don't think the president has made this case. There's certainly issues at the border, but not maybe that would be addressed by the wall. This isn't uncommon. You know, you've been telling us for a budget to be DOA. But so what is the significance of it?
The significance of the wall is very high for the president. This has become the number one priority for him. It's almost a symbol of his presidency. And of course, that has helped have Democrats see stopping it as a symbol of their opposition to him. But he believes that even though the border wall is not popular with the majority of Americans, certainly shutting down the government or declaring a national emergency to fund it is even less popular. But with his base, it's very popular. He considers it a core campaign promise, and he wants to show his supporters that he is doing everything possible to build it.
Will that mean another government shutdown, though, that far?
We don't know, but it certainly could. Sure.
Okay. Well, the president also proposed these dramatic cuts we mentioned to domestic programs to rein in the ballooning federal deficit. But a lot of the chatter over the weekend seemed to be that no one seems to care about the deficit as they did in the past.
I think both parties have really given up trying to wear the mantle of fiscal responsibility. This used to be one of the Republicans' core beliefs. But Donald Trump cut taxes by a lot, and he raised the deficit on his watch more than any of his predecessors. In his budget now, he does have some cuts to domestic spending, which I think he will point to say he's trying to do something about the deficit. He's got the EPA down by 31%, State Department down by 23%. Military spending is up. But the deficit is just not an animating political issue the way it used to be. And don't forget, the president actually campaigned on not just getting rid of the deficit, but getting rid of the entire national debt.
Yeah. Take a look at the other side of the aisle. How are Democrats beginning this week? Last week ended with what was seen as a real fumble on that what was supposed to be an anti-Semitism resolution that became a much broader resolution against hate. Democrats also having trouble defining themselves, as Republicans happily were defining them as socialists. Some of the presidential candidates are democratic socialists, but that means things like government-run health. It does not mean Karl Marx, but they seem not able to define themselves. I mean, what's your sense of Democrats this week?
Well, I think that Democrats are having trouble defining what they mean by socialism. We know what the president means. He's labeling Democrats as the party of socialism, which he means Cuba and Venezuela. He says Democrats want to nationalize industry and have the government run everything. Most Democrats want a strong social safety net. That's what they mean when they respond positively to socialism. They want affordable health care and college and retirement and housing. And this is something you're going to hear a lot about on the campaign trail. You have Elizabeth Warren talking about how she believes in markets properly regulated. Bernie Sanders, of course, is on the other side. It does have a proposal that would nationalize the entire healthcare industry, at least the health insurance industry. So this is something you're going to hear Democrats talk a lot about. I think that right now they have allowed the president to define what socialism is. But I think as time goes on, you're going to hear them get more specific about what it means to them.
And just to remind ourselves, the emergency declaration, the Senate vote is expected this week. Four Republicans still saying they'll join the Democrats in voting it down.
That's right. It probably will lose in the Senate, but the president will veto it. And there are not enough votes in the House or Senate to override his veto. So then the whole fight moves to the courts, which will go on for some time. So it's interesting that he's asking for $8 billion more for the wall in a budget that's landing on Capitol Hill exactly in the same week that the Senate is about to vote down his emergency declaration to build the wall with money that Congress has not appropriated.
And Piers Morilison, thank you.
Thank you.
Now to the serious questions raised today about the safety of Boeing's new 737 MAX airplane after an Ethiopian Airlines flight of that model crashed Sunday with 157 people on board. There was a similar deadly Lion Air crash in October on the same type of plane. Officials say a central factor in that crash was a new anti-stall flight control system. Joining us now is Dennis Tager, a pilot for American Airlines and a spokesman for the union. He also flies the new 737 MAX 8. Captain, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Now, it is still far too early to know if the cause of this crash is the same as that Lion Air crash last year, but what's your reaction? Are you suspicious?
Absolutely. Clearly, we have to wait for all the facts to come in, but it did happen in a similar flight regime. It had characteristics that are eerily similar to the Lion Air incident, but it does not mean that that is the automated system that kicked in that we weren't aware of prior to Lion Air kicked in. So we are awaiting all the details, but just like any human experience, our pilots are humans, and they're starting to call the question, what information don't I have?
And you're referring to the fact that Boeing had left out the information about this new flight control system from its manuals, I assume, for this new plane.
That is correct. From the pilot manual, what we study and prepare for, the information was absent. It was zero.
Can we talk about some of the clues that we do have in this crash in Ethiopia? A witness described the flight as swerving and dipping before it crashed, and it also does look like that the altitude fluctuated a lot during the few minutes that the plane was flying. Are those the characteristics that you mentioned that sound similar to you?
Yeah, they do sound similar. There's no doubt about it. But it doesn't necessarily mean that this was the issue that caused the crash to happen. So we're going to get that information, and we're going to move from there with the facts. Our pilots are asking those questions now. They're asking about additional training. They're asking about what information they may not have that they thought they should have had before. So it's a very stressful time for our men and women out there. But they're going to hold the standard of having a safe aircraft for our passengers. They hold that calling very high because we're on that airplane with our passengers. No mystery about that.
Sure. What about the training? Have you gotten any new training whatsoever on how to fly these aircraft? Should others be getting it?
Unfortunately, the FAA certified this new aircraft in the U.S. We had 56 minutes of an iPad lesson for some of the differences. So we've asked for more training. American, after the Lion Air incident, provided us immediate ground school training on the new system, which was helpful. But we implored them to purchase simulators so that we get hands-on experience. They have purchased simulators. We'll be getting them later this year and start training on them. And we look forward to additional simulators through the coming months.
But you're saying you were trained on an iPad and that's it? So what does that even mean?
Yes, we received an iPad lesson, 56 minutes long, basically slides and some audio to describe some of the differences on the 737 MAX, because at the time, the FAA, and still to this day, approved that as the required training for pilots. We found it to be certainly at the absolute minimum. Our pilots have been out there flying the aircraft. I've flown it, and I felt comfortable, but it's taken a lot more time, and you have to be very diligent in what you do and do a little quite a bit of pre-study.
Well, let me ask you, if you were confronted with this situation in a cockpit during a flight where the anti-stall system kicked in and you were fighting against it, would you know what to do?
I would now. I wouldn't have known before Lion Air crash.
Wow.
Because I had no idea that system even existed before the Lion Air crash. That's the difference today. Each and every one of our 737 pilots knows as soon as these things kick in, where to go to stop that runaway system.
China and Indonesia have grounded their fleets of 737 MAX 8 jets. Should the United States be doing the same thing?
I think we have to clearly look at it. We're not in a position to say whether that should happen, but clearly every stakeholder is talking about this. So we want to take a disciplined approach to it, but not let perfection get in the way of progress. So this is about protecting passengers and crews and the land underneath the aircraft that the aircraft fly over.
But certainly you could understand the flying public at this point might be getting nervous. If they step on board a Southwest Airlines jet or an American Airlines jet that is one of these new 737 MAX aircrafts, they're going to be nervous.
Sure, absolutely. There's going to be a shake in confidence in that. So you have to rest assured that on American and Southwest, we know them very well, those pilots, highly trained, and we're up to date now on those system, the MCAS system that you spoke of. But we're out there as a defender and an advocate for our passengers, and we're asking those hard questions, and we're asking them from a basis of expertise. We're going to get through this. And we're not going to be quiet about it, and we're going to render our opinion when we get the information very strongly, because we're on that aircraft with our passengers, and our task is to protect them at all costs.
That's Dennis Tager, who flies Boeing's new 737 MAX 8 airplane for American Airlines. He's also a spokesman for the Allied Pilots Association. Captain Tager, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
And what's it like to come face-to-face with a great white shark? Well, Brian Scarry is one person who knows. As a National Geographic photographer, he spent more than 10,000 hours just a few feet from the animals. In 2017, he published a book of his pictures, aptly titled Shark. I spoke with him then about how, unlike most wildlife photographers, he's usually within touching distance of his subjects.
You know, I don't know that most people think about that, but as an underwater photographer, you know, I don't have the luxury that my terrestrial counterparts do, where you can use a 600 millimeter lens or maybe sit in a camouflage blind for a month waiting for some elusive animal. I have to get into the ocean. I'm limited by the air supply on my back and got to get real close.
How close?
Right on the lens, practically. You know, to get great pictures, particularly of animals like sharks, you need to be close. You know, the ocean acts as a giant filter. It refracts light, it reflects light, it scatters light. And I usually need to add a little light to bring back color and detail. So, you know, 3 feet is ideal between your camera and the subject, but sometimes even closer.
Well, and I ask that because you have to get close to animals that would terrify most people. There's a section in your book written by Eric Vance, and it's about great whites. And I want to read a little bit about it.
Sure.
He says that meeting one in the wild is nothing like you'd expect. At first glance, it's portly, bordering on fat like an overstuffed sausage. From the side, one of the world's greatest predators is little more than a slack-jawed buffoon. It's only when it turns to face you that you understand why it's the most feared animal on Earth.
Yeah.
Is that what it was like for you?
Well, that's a very interesting description. I spent time in the field with Eric, and I was sort of amused at that description. But at times, yeah, I think, you know, with the great white, that it is accurate. But he's absolutely right that when you're sort of nose to nose with an animal like this, or you see it sort of approaching you from that head on view, you know, you have this primal sort of reaction, I think.
So how do you handle that? Are you always in a cage?
I'm only in a cage with great whites. At least that's my sort of protocol. There are people who do choose to swim with great whites without a cage, but so far I haven't seen that as a really good thing to do. But, but you know, it's really the only species. Everything else, makos, blue sharks, tiger sharks, whatever, I'm not in a cage. And that's because, number one, for photography, it's better to sort of be out there, you know, having more mobility and being able to move and get close. But it's also a testament to the animals that, you know, despite popular belief, they're really not nearly as bad as they've been portrayed.
Is there a time that you've been down there and you've felt in danger?
Well, there was a moment on an expedition. I did a five-week expedition to a place called the Southern Line Islands, one of the most remote coral reef systems in the world in the central South Pacific. Also, like going back in time. So these coral reefs were probably like the rest of the world was hundreds of years ago, and they're very predator heavy, lots of sharks. I was diving one night at Millennium Atoll at, well, not night, but just at dusk, at sunset. And my assistant and I ended up being sort of surrounded by probably in excess of 60 gray reef sharks. Wow. And gray reef sharks are beautiful animals, but they can have a bit of an attitude. And they were, you know, aggressive. They sort of were coming in hot, as I say. And normally, if an animal does that, you can sort of bounce it with your camera a little bit, and they usually are deterred. But
you hit the shark with your camera.
Yeah, they'll come in and sort of bounce their nose off it. Mm. And if you push back a little bit, they usually deter. But in this case, they weren't doing that. The lead shark was doing like a 360 coming back in, and behind that was 5, and behind that was another 10. And, you know, it wasn't a great situation.
So there's an alpha like in a pack of dogs?
It almost seemed that way. Mm. I don't know the science behind that, but that's how they were sort of behaving, kind of like I envision a wolf pack. But again, that is totally anomalous. That's not my usual experience, that, you know, one experience versus countless that were very benign and good.
When you're taking pictures underwater, what's it like to get perspective right? Because you're working in this very foreign backdrop where you probably don't have a lot of ways to reference size and scale, and yet that's a really important part of taking pictures of a shark.
That is so good, and rarely, I don't know, ever have I been asked that, but it's true. And I do talk about that in the book as well, that, you know, to the degree that I can do it, I want to show sharks within their world, within their habitat, whether it's a coral reef or a temperate zone or whatever it might be, a mangrove nursery where baby sharks might live. But I do think that context is very important to human understanding of these animals, to see them as something more than just this, you know, villainous shape up in the blue void. Sometimes it means having a person in the picture to give scale or a shark cage or some reference point that we can process in our brains and say, all right, that shark is about this big, and, you know, but it's an important part of the equation. And it helps frame the context of these animals and their world.
And conservation is actually a pretty big part of your book, especially near the end. And it's a little disturbing, actually, because you've taken images of people, I assume they're poachers of some kind or hunters, that are cutting the fins off of sharks. And I assume the bodies are also just sort of left on the beach to rot. The stat that you use is that industrial fishing is responsible for most of the 100 million shark deaths every year. 100 million. I mean, how is that even possible?
Yeah, it's hard to fathom, really, but it's not only possible, but it's been going on for a long time. Most researchers that I've talked to about this say that it could be a conservative number, that the number could be as high as 170 or 200 million, largely for their fins.
Yeah. Are we talking about, you know, soup in China or something?
That's exactly what we're talking about. Yeah, the shark fin soup trade. But they're also being harvested in many cases for low-cost sources of ingredients for cosmetics and many different products out there. But the fin trade is the biggest offender, according to everything that I know. Mm. And to your point about poaching, in many cases, no, it's completely legal what these folks are doing. And, you know, countries sanction it. So a big part of my work is been to sort of show these animals as something far more than villains, as demons, as they've often been portrayed, to show that they're complex, that they have a personality, and that they are important to the health of the ocean. You know, if we can get to a point where we can see their magnificence, maybe we can move that dial away from killing them.
You write that the population of the oceanic white-tip shark, I had never even heard of that animal before, is down to 1% of its historic population. How endangered is that species, and is that the most endangered species?
First part of your question, it's extremely endangered. It's on the brink of extinction. This is an animal, the oceanic white-tip shark, which is a pelagic animal, lives out in the blue water, the deep water of the ocean, an animal that has to be especially efficient at hunting and good at what they do. As recently as the 1970s, this is an animal that was listed by scientific literature as the most abundant large animal on planet Earth, large meaning anything more than 100 pounds. So it went from the 1970s being the most abundant large animal on planet Earth to being on the verge of extinction today, mostly hunted for their fins, not unlike the passenger pigeon or what we did to the American bison, almost wiping that out. So it is critically endangered. It is on the verge. And that's a substantial loss in just a few decades. Is it the most endangered? I don't know the answer to that. I certainly think that there are probably others in that same category, but it is without question one of the most endangered, and I think that story speaks volumes.
It's fascinating because these animals have been on Earth for 450 million years. Right. They've survived five mass extinctions on this planet. And yet, generally speaking, now they're having trouble.
Yeah, that's right. And that's part of the story, you know, that they have been around so long. They've remained unchanged for millions of years, hundreds of millions of years, because they have evolved to be perfect for the environment in which they live. But yet these anthropogenic stresses that are occurring today, obviously the overfishing and the hunting, but habitat loss and pollution and plastics and all the other things that are happening in the ocean. The ocean's dying a death of a thousand cuts, and it's affecting sharks, but everything else.
But can you understand why people are afraid of them and why it might be hard to drum up sympathy for sharks? Because, you know, as we're children, we're taught, one of the first things we're taught is that they can bite through license plates and cans of paint. And you go to the beach, and when you're a kid, that's the first thing you're afraid of when you step into the water.
Well, absolutely. And this is the premise from which I started, knowing that, you know, I too, as a child, was taught those things and believed those things. But I've come to see a very different view of these animals. And I do think that we can respect predators in the ocean just like we do grizzly bears or tigers, lions, you know, all these wolves, whatever. We understand their magnificence. And I think what's been lost to a large extent with sharks is that complexity. We don't necessarily see them as a majestic creature the way we do a pack of wolves in Yellowstone, you know? But I think photography can serve that purpose, and it can help people to understand that a shark is not a shark is not a shark, that each species is different. They have unique biologies. They have unique morphologies. And if we can see them as something incredible, you know, that a mako shark can swim 60 miles an hour and is endothermic, it can generate heat in its body, and that the great whites off Cape Cod live to 70 years old, and they have these enigmatic patterns that we don't fully understand yet. Where do they go? What wisdom might they possess? And then again, you know, making that connection to a healthy ocean, our healthy lives, to humans, I think that's all part of the equation.
That was National Geographic wildlife photographer Brian Scarry. I spoke with him in 2017. We'll have pictures from the book at hereandnow.org. And we went looking for other shark news, and what do you know? We found some. It's taken 30 years, but University of Rhode Island shark researcher Bradley Weatherby has finally named the shark species he discovered in the 1990s. The deep sea creature has been dubbed Layla's lantern shark. The bioluminescent shark is 3 feet long. It lives 1,000 feet below sea level, has a prominent snout that distinguishes it from other lantern sharks. He named the shark after his daughter Layla, who is presumably not luminescent, though full of light in other ways, I'm sure.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who wants you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs, from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
It was a rare moment last night. The Federal Reserve Chairman, Jerome Powell, sitting down for an interview with Scott Pelley on CBS's 60 Minutes. Powell repeated the message he relayed to Congress about 2 weeks ago. The U.S. economy still looks pretty good.
We have high levels of employment, low levels of unemployment, wages are moving up.
But Powell also touched on problems with the U.S. economy, like cyber threats and why so many Americans still aren't working. Let's bring in Jill Schlesinger. She's business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So the two things people most want to know, especially after this really crummy jobs report last week, just 20,000 new jobs in February, is the economy headed for a recession? And is the Fed going to raise rates? What did Powell have to say last night?
You know, the chairman basically said that the economic outlook is really pretty good. And forgetting about that one report and that job creation number, he continued to describe this as an economy with low inflation, which is very good for most consumers. He's very happy about the fact that people are getting jobs. And with the second part of your question, the Fed has now said it's going to be patient to see about what goes on around the world with the economy, but they're pretty pretty much on the sidelines right now. So I would not expect any rate hike anytime soon. A lot of economists believe that they are done for the year and maybe for this whole rate hiking cycle.
There was also this interesting moment when Scott Pelley asked if the United States will ever again see sustained 4% growth. And Powell said no, it's not likely because the labor force is growing so slowly. Jill, weigh in on that, because we know the Trump administration would really love to say otherwise about that growth rate.
Yeah, I mean, I think that 3% was great last year. What we now know is that we've slowed down already this year. And what Powell said is that, look, we have a labor force that's growing pretty old at this point. Back when we saw 4 or 5% growth rates in, you know, decades ago, we were seeing a much quicker growing labor force. So now with an older population, we just cannot expect as much. I think that 3% is about as good as it's going to get. And Powell seemed to indicate that as well. He says right now with a labor force growing at just less than 1% a year, we're not going to see that 3% or even 4% growth anytime soon.
And it's not just that the labor force is aging. It's that a lot of young people aren't working. Powell blames technology outpacing education. He mentioned globalization and even the opioid crisis. Here's more of that interview.
I mean, you seem to be talking about part of this generation being lost.
That is the issue.
Jill, a lost generation, really? That's very powerful.
Yeah, I found that to be one of the most compelling parts of this interview. And I think that Scott did a good job in kind of going down that route, because we're talking about the economy doing well. And certainly Powell talks about the economy doing well. But there are a number of Americans who have not participated. We notice this in areas that are especially the rural areas of the United States that have not kept pace with some of the big population centers. And it's all fair, well and good for Powell to say it's about education, but that seems like cold comfort to those who have been shut out of economic growth recently, because they can't go and get educated right this second.
When a Fed chairman talks, markets often move. What are we seeing today? Anything?
No, I don't think that he said anything. He really didn't make news. I think the biggest thing that he did say, which raised some eyebrows, was that he's worried about cyber terrorism more than anything else.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thanks so much.
The CDC estimates that every year in the U.S., 24,000 pregnancies end in stillbirth. Some expected, and for medical reasons, mothers still have to deliver anyway. Some a shock, all profoundly sad. Until recently, these infants were whisked away, stunned parents told, "You can have another." Well, that thinking has changed. There are support groups. Parents are encouraged to mourn their stillborn child. And now they may have more time to do that because of a device called a cuddle cot. It's essentially a pretty bassinet. The stillborn child appears asleep in it. But underneath, there's a refrigerator unit to preserve the child's body so that parents can preserve some memories. This is a very tender topic. It may not be for everyone, and a cuddle cot may not be either, but it so helped Emily and Chris Fricker after their boy and girl twins were stillborn at 22 weeks and 4 days that they've donated these nearly $3,000 cuddle cots to two hospitals in Illinois and want to do more. They join us now from Pingree Grove, Illinois. Emily, you there?
Hi, yes, I'm here.
And Chris, you're there as well.
Hi, yes, I'm here also.
And so tough. We so appreciate your talking about this for other parents, but I'm imagining it's still hard, Emily. Oh, dear. Emily, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. I'm just trying to get my words out.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah. Take your time.
I think it's been about 6 months now. And it is still very difficult to talk about. At the same time, Chris and I do still like to talk about it because it brings awareness to people who don't understand the situation. We didn't know that this could happen to people before it happened to us. With it being our first pregnancy. So if we had maybe been able to hear somebody else's story before, we could have maybe been a little bit more prepared.
Yeah, well, I don't know that anything can, but I hear what you're saying. And what you're saying, too, maybe about the cuddle cot, about the possibilities. And Chris, obviously so sorry for both of you. And when this hit you, like I'm sure an anvil, did you have any clue that you could do some of these things that thankfully people are talking about? Hold your twins, for instance.
No, not at all. We first learned about the cuddle cot from our delivery nurse, who was wonderful. Her name is Brittany. She was with us the entire evening, and we knew that our twins probably weren't going to make it just based on their gestational age. What we didn't know is that we would be able to spend really as long as we wanted with them. And we got to spend that first hour, hour and a half with them, just kind of holding them, telling them how much we love them. We got them baptized while they were still with us. The cuddle cot afforded us the opportunity for all of our family to also be able to hold them, be able to, you know, kind of get to know them as much as they can, and just kind of grieve with us, with the twins in the room with us, with everybody holding them, instead of just being able to give Emily and I a hug. And I thought that was really impactful. And it's, it is sad that there's a lot of hospitals in the country that don't have one. And so there's a lot of parents that approach losing a child without having that immediate support right there. And of course, family is supportive and the doctors are supportive, but there's nothing like being able to just hold on to your child for just a little bit longer.
Well, Emily, I just want to stay with that feeling of being able to be, you know, with the twins longer. I think of my own mother who, you know, had several children whisked away, and she would talk about her arms aching, you know, physical ache. Can you help people understand why this isn't ghoulish to you, which people hearing it might think it is?
No, it is something that is definitely a decision that you have to make with between you and whoever you have the child with, or even if you're just on your own, to stay with your child even after they've passed. But the opportunity to be able to do that the cuddle cot offers, is at least it's an option for people to do that and spend time with their children or child. If they didn't want to use it, they didn't necessarily have to, but at least it was offered. And that was something that was important to Chris and I when we were doing the donations of the cuddle cots to the hospitals we chose, was that they agreed to at least offer it to every family that had a loss, and give them the opportunity to spend time with their baby or babies. And if they didn't want to use it, then they didn't have to, but at least it was available to them if they chose to do it.
Can you explain how, as your husband has, what it meant to you? I mean, it may not be for everyone, but what did that mean to you to be able to hold them?
I think for me, it was like spending a lifetime with them in a few hours. And I'm very glad that we made the decision to do that. I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Well, you have a GoFundMe account in their honor?
Yeah, our boy's name is Silas, and our girl's name is Sybil.
Yeah, and that's important, too. I mean, again, back in the day, parents were told, don't name these children, don't get too attached to the idea. But what has this meant that not just naming, baptizing, I'm sure you're going to tell your future children about them. What does that mean to you?
You know, for me, it makes them human, because they were, you know, they were here with us, and we had just bought a new house shortly after finding out that we were pregnant. I had picked up the paint for their nursery the day that Emily actually went into labor with them. Mm-hmm. Obviously not knowing, we had just decided on their names about a week or two before. I think it was a week before. They were as much a part of our life as any other child. And I sincerely mean that. even if they're not here with us now. You know, I really do feel like I carry them with me every single day. I wish it was in a different way. Every time I'm driving to work, you know, I bought a new vehicle and I always thought about what it's like to have them in my truck with me. And every single day when I'm driving to work or I'm driving home from work, it's pretty much all I think about.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you're right. A lot of people in the past, you know, haven't named their child that has passed. And that's okay too. But it's also okay to let a child that didn't make it still be a part of your life. You know, it's okay to still carry that child with you. And you're absolutely right. We will tell our future children about them because it's not something that, it's not a story that we're shy about sharing. It's important. It's important for us to carry them with us. It's important for other people to know that they were here. They're a part of our family. And it's important for people that we don't know to know that there's other people out there that can help support them.
That's Chris Fricker and Emily Fricker. They're boy and girl twins born at 22 weeks, 4 days. And the Frickers turned to something called a cuddle cot. We're going to have all sorts of information at hereandnow.org, including their GoFundMe site. Such an important conversation. I will tell you this, just from the front lines, we still talk about my brother's twin who didn't make it. Her name was Wendy, 70 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, we plan on telling our future kids about them. You know, it's something that I don't ever want to forget about any of the emotions that I felt. Or yeah, I mean, that's just, and it's okay that some people do want to forget about that, but that's not us.
I wish you both the best.
Thank you for
thank you so much
on our GoFundMe too. I hope that helps. We're about halfway to being able to donate a third, and so I think this will be able to help with that.
Emily, Chris, thank you so much, and we wish you the best.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank
I
you,
really
Robin.
Appreciate that.
And we have a link to the GoFundMe page and the cuddle cot hereandnow.org.
Each year, fishing boats pull billions of pollock from the Bering Sea. The billion-dollar industry sustains thousands of well-paying jobs, from boat captains and deckhands to the processors who transform pollock into oil, fish paste, and yes, fish sticks. But the Bering Sea is warming up, and the future for pollock is uncertain. Nat Herz of Alaska's Energy Desk took a trip on a fishing boat to learn more.
It's just before midnight as Captain Dan Martin steers the 133-foot Commodore out from the Alaska port of Dutch Harbor, around a spit into the open waters of the Bering Sea. It's calm now, but Martin is already pushing his engine to cover the 100 miles to the fishing grounds a little faster than usual. He's in a hurry to beat some bad weather.
Oh, it's imminent. You know, 10 to 14-foot seas, but it's going to be right on our bow coming home. We're going to be pounding into it.
Martin has been fishing for pollock for more than 3 decades, and he has a pretty good feel for where to find them. He now manages a fleet of 9 pollock boats for a company called Evening Star Fisheries. Sure enough, by the next morning, the sonar shows the Commodore camped out over a thick school of pollock. From the bridge, Martin uses a PA system to coordinate with his 4-man crew on deck as they start pulling in the net.
Our motor should be around the other side.
Pollock are a low-value fish. Martin's catch will sell for about 30 cents a piece. But more than 100,000 of them can fit into a single net load on the Commodore. They'll ultimately be processed into things like fish sticks, filet-o-fish sandwiches, and surimi, that fake crab stuff that you can sometimes find in sushi. It's a major industry responsible for more than 10,000 jobs, according to the McDowell Group, an Alaska-based research firm. But it's also directly dependent on the stability of the Bering Sea ecosystem. And Martin says that lately, fishermen have been noticing some changes in that ecosystem.
I think across the board, everybody has a story, you know, about something that they haven't seen before.
Winter is the season when pollock are spawning, and fishermen seem to be able to find them pretty reliably. But there's a second fishing season in the summer, and that's when things are starting to get a little funny. Bering Sea temperatures last year were as much as 9 degrees higher than normal, and federal managers tracking pollock and other fish found some unusual things. Jim Iannelli is a federal fisheries scientist.
2018, there were lots of weird occurrences in terms of fish showing up in places. Like our survey found a pretty high density of pollock way in interior Bristol Bay that we had. It was really unusual. I'd never really seen that before.
Those pollock were further to the east. Iannelli says that fish were also discovered farther north than expected. Martin, the Commodore captain, had his own unsettling experience when he was fishing in an area called the Horseshoe. Typically, the fish stick close to an underwater shelf there, and Martin knows it as a relatively safe spot where he doesn't have to worry about accidentally catching king salmon, a huge no-no for pollock trawlers. But last summer, Martin found himself following the fish 10 miles off the edge.
But I just kept following my sonar farther and farther and farther off, and it was like kind of getting to the deep end of the pool. You know, you were like, well, don't have my water wings, and I haven't been this deep before. So that, as the fish change behavior, you don't have any historical values to weigh things against.
Even if pollock continue to fare well in the Bering Sea, Martin is worried about what could happen if more of them move out of their normal areas to places too expensive for boats like his to reach and requiring major changes in the way the fishing fleet does business. Back on deck, the crew members wrangle the Commodore's net, bulging with pollock. Then they pump in water to flush the flopping fish out into the boat's hold. It takes just a few hours to fill the Commodore's hold with more than 200 tons of fish, and the boat is back in Dutch Harbor barely 24 hours after it left. This is Martin's 35th year fishing. He's already made a good living from the Bering Sea, but younger fishermen are staking their careers on pollock sticking around for decades longer. Derek Justice, a deckhand on the Commodore from Washington, first went fishing to pay his way through school, but then he made $40,000 over the course of a few months. That plan for college?
Nope, didn't even make it there. Nope.
Justice, at just 24 years old, is already making more than $100,000 a year. He wants to work his way up to being captain of a pollock boat. If climate change makes it impossible for him to keep fishing, Justice says he thinks he can take his skills to a related field, like on a cruise ship or a tugboat. But that would cut him off from a family tradition of catching pollock.
It's pretty much all I know. So yeah, I mean, it'd be pretty devastating. To say the least, it's something I can't fathom.
But Justice tries not to spend too much time thinking about the warming Bering Sea. Mother Nature is going to take its course, he says. For Here and Now, I'm Nat Herz.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.